Welcome to Let's Consider the Source, the weekly media issues talk show here on SiriusXM Public Radio. I'm your host, Bob Mann. An anonymous source told me, you know, you hear that a lot on the air and in newspapers, and sometimes the anonymous source is absolutely key to a journalist getting a story from someone who fears identification or retribution. But sometimes it can be overused and lead to some very bad places. That's one of the many subjects we're going to be talking about on this episode of the program with one of our regulars and favorite contributors, Rem Ryder, who is media editor and columnist for USA Today. Rem, how are you making out in the middle of March Madness? When I follow your Twitter feed, it seems that you're a little obsessed.
Obsessed now, kind of a little in despair. I'm a Philly guy, and both St. Joe's and Villanova were taken out last week. I had an exchange of emails with my friend Larry Kramer, the president and publisher of USA Today, and a huge Syracuse fan. They, of course, were knocked out. And I wrote to him after the Nova loss. I said, I don't know about you, but I'm not loving March Madness. And he said, as far as I'm concerned, it's baseball season.
Yes, it does happen very quickly and abruptly. Well, I'm going to ease your mind from all your loss from the March Madness with some happy talk about idle speculation about missing aircraft, invasions of Crimea, and misuse of anonymous sources here. Let's begin a piece that you wrote very recently in USA Today about the need to really start reining in anonymous sources. Give us a little background as to why a journalist would, for a positive reason, use an anonymous source or make an anonymous quote, and where things can start to go bad.
Okay, you know, I'm sure a lot of the public wonders, you know, why anonymous sources are used so often. And there's no doubt that constant use of them can hurt credibility of journalism. And understandably, I mean, a reader is going to say, well, why isn't, you know, who, I don't know who this person is. I don't even know if it's a real person. There actually is a good reason for anonymity, and an awful lot of important investigative stories that have done a lot to help society would be impossible without them. And that's situations when people might put their lives in danger or be in danger of losing their jobs, where there's a perfectly rational reason not to use the name. There are also instances like, if you really want to know what's going on in the intelligence community or at the White House or at the Supreme Court, people who work there are just not going to talk on the record. And you'd miss out on a lot of important stuff if you had an absolute ban. Bob Woodward, who the longtime journalist of Watergate fame and has written a lot of books, Woodward has always said that the important thing is the quality of the information, not the identity of the source. So that's the reason that they're sometimes used.
Now, when you talk about Barbara Woodward, one of the things I remember from All the President's Men is Ben Bradley constantly yelling, you still have to have a second source, you still have to corroborate that. Is that in journalism today still required of the anonymous source by most editors, most producers? Do they say, okay, fine, you've got somebody and they're not willing to go on the record with their identity, but you better get a second source. Is that still one of the things required, talking about the days of Woodward and Bernstein?
It varies so much from place to place, and the, you know, our media world is so much more complex now. With, you know, we're not just talking about legacy institutions like newspapers; they're websites of all varieties and all varieties of standards. But even at newspapers, there's no uniformity on this. I think everybody is more comfortable and tries very hard to get multiple sources when you're using anonymity. But now and then, if you have access to a source that you know has firsthand knowledge, is in a position to know, and it's somebody you've dealt with and trust, you know, I think in a case like that, you're still okay going ahead with it.
Now, you've given some very good reasons why reporters use anonymous sources. So for anybody in the audience who's saying they shouldn't use them to begin with, I think you can see the rationale for doing so. But you also referred to something written by Margaret Sullivan in the New York Times and put your own take on this, about the fact that you can, for example, anonymously smear someone with a quote, and that's where it starts to go down the slippery slope, or have wild speculation about what happened with Malaysian Air Flight 370, which is not based on anything in reality. These are some of the examples where it does go too far, right?
That's absolutely right, and the reason I wrote about Margaret Sullivan, she's the public editor of the New York Times, a position where She doesn't set policy or decide what goes in the paper, but she's kind of an in-house critic. She hears from the public and deals with their complaints and kind of reads as a critical reader herself. And she started a new thing where she's going to spotlight misuse of anonymous sources in the Times. And I think that's great, because even though a lot of papers have policies where they say you're not allowed to have somebody anonymously smear someone or take a cheap shot or do other kinds of things that really are inappropriate, very often in kind of the day-to-day heat of putting out the paper, these sources are used incorrectly. And so Sullivan has done a great thing. And in her first column, she spotlighted two examples, one in which a source was allowed to say something like, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo doesn't really have any friends, which may or may not be true. But again, I don't think you want to give license. You know, if you want him to say something like that, you darn well better put your name to it. And then the other was a case of an anonymous pilot speculating rather wildly about what happened on Flight 370. Both perfect examples of where there's no business using an anonymous source. And to the credit of the managing editor of the New York Times, Dean Baquet, he agreed when she brought these to him that these were both mistakes. And I think her, you know, having her high-profile spotlight on this at the Times, which is our leading news organization, could really be a tonic not just for the Times, but also for journalists across the country. It really brings the issue to the fore.
Well, Rem has been a guest, as any of you who listen to the show on a regular basis, he's been a guest with us for years, for the 7 years that the program has been on. And in his previous incarnation, he was the editor of the American Journalism Review. You and I had many conversations about the so-called newspaper ombudsman or ombudswoman. Is that what Margaret Sullivan is at the Times, basically, the one who kind of represents the public as a surrogate in terms of dealing with her own newspaper's possible mistakes or ethical gaps?
That's exactly right. Yeah, I think at many places they're called ombudsmen. I shouldn't say many, because far too few news organizations have them. But yes, her job is kind of be the public face of the paper in terms of interacting with the publics, with hearing their concerns. And she's done something that I think is really impressive. Typically, the reader representatives or ombudsmen or public editors have written perhaps a weekly column or an every other week column in the print product. She started right off the bat writing almost daily for the New York Times website. And I think that's a huge step forward for the practice, so that she's commenting in real time on issues facing the paper, so the paper can deal with them more quickly, respond to them more quickly. And it's really taking the craft quite a bit further. She still writes a print column every other week, I think. But in our era, I mean, that real time is crucial. And she did something really interesting once, where it was an issue that she couldn't really resolve in quickly. But she at least referred to it. It was when there was a big controversy when the Times reviewed the car, the Tesla, and it was very critical, and the owner of the company took on at the Times and actually had a lot of points that raised questions about the findings of the writer. And she came up with this kind of an interim column saying, I haven't sorted this out yet, but I'm on it. Yes, we know there's a dispute here, and we're looking into it. And I thought that was really a perfect kind of use of the website for this era, where things are, you know, in the age of Twitter, you know, things are being debated instantly, and just to know that a news outlet was taking it that seriously right away, rather than, you know, waiting, you know, for a couple of weeks or whatever it took to sort it out, I thought it was really positive.
Yeah, you really couldn't do that in print. It'd be like, what do you mean you're telling us in something that's published and is going to be around for 24 hours that you're on it, that you're working on it? Whereas, you know, very McLuhanistic, you know, the medium is the message online in real time. It's like, okay, cool, I'll wait for that. I'll be looking for that.
Exactly right.
Now, I'm wondering if Margaret is the least popular person at 8th Avenue and 40th Street in Manhattan in the New York Times building. It sounds like your job is like being in internal affairs for the police department.
That's true. We did a piece when I was at American Journalism Review. We did a piece on the role of the ombudsman, and the headline was "The Loneliest Guy in the Newsroom." And
no birthday parties, no after work drinks, just
no. You know, you need bodyguards and food tasters, and actually, it really varies. I have a friend who had been an editor of a paper, and then she became an ombudsman, and she was very turned off by the defensiveness of a lot of the journalists. She even said to me once, you know, I went in thinking I'd love the journalists and hate the readers, and it kind of came out the other way around. But she also said there were some journalists who were really scrupulous about it, and even though they knew they might be embarrassed, were willing to, you know, to take the criticism head on.
You know, though, when you work at the Times building at 8th Avenue and 40th Street, right across from the Port Authority, you might as well have a food taster and a bodyguard anyway. So I think it's probably very convenient for Margaret.
Exactly right. I think it's part of her contract.
It works for both inside and outside the building. You're listening to Let's Consider the Source. This is our weekly media issues talk show on SiriusXM. I'm Bob Mann, my guest, one of our favorite contributors, Rem Ryder. And you can read Rem Ryder in USA Today. And as a matter of fact, Rem, why don't you take this opportunity to talk about your Twitter feed, about you in print in USA Today, and also online.
Well, thanks. Twitter feed is at Rem Ryder. And as far as the columns, I write columns that appear frequently on the website and appear in print almost every Tuesday and Thursday, and sometimes more often than that. So they're on the usatoday.com site. They're in print Tuesday and Thursday, and Twitter, Facebook, everywhere else.
And I will do some blatant self-promotion as well. I've just revamped www.bobmannmedia, bobmannmedia.com. So please go there. Much more frequent updates concerning the show and who is on, and my Twitter handle at bobmannmedia. You know, she actually, Margaret Sullivan, gave us a perfect segue here talking about idle speculation about Flight 370. John Stewart was hysterical. He had the logo for American Idol, except it was American IDLE speculation. CNN really went over the top, didn't they, filling 24 hours with everything from talking about the possibility that it was a black hole or what happened in the show Lost?
Absolutely. It was, a really embarrassing chapter in journalism. And, you know, I'm sympathetic to CNN's plight. I mean, they were the pioneer in cable news, and they were, you know, had a reputation for years of kind of straight down the middle reporting. And then as time passed, and as it developed two competitors in the news game, one of them, of course, Fox News, had extraordinary success with a very distinct conservative slant on the news. MSNBC, which had been kind of struggling for an identity, kind of jump-started itself when it became the left-wing equivalent of Fox News, and CNN's ratings began to lag and became seen as kind of tired, and they kind of fell into third place. And Jeff Zucker, former head of NBC Universal, was brought in to turn this around. And there are no real easy answers. You know, you can change the personnel on the various shows, which is kind of rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. One of the things that I was completely unimpressed by is they brought back Crossfire, that talking head scream fest that had been buried for a long time. But what he discovered early on was that saturation coverage of certain stories would bring back viewers. And the first one early in his tenure was with one of those cruise ships from hell, where the passengers were trapped on the flight, and they're with big toilet problems and no food and terrible conditions. And they went overboard with it, and the ratings jumped. So in the case of the missing airline, it was an amazing story. I mean, it's just a fascinating saga. No question it deserved and deserves heavy attention. They basically went to all plane all the time. The website BuzzFeed did a little measuring and found that in one day, in 300 out of 371 broadcast minutes, 356 of them were devoted to the plane. That's just crazy.
And it's not just coverage, though, Rem. That's the real point. I mean, Stewart was doing it for his usual satirical motivations. But when you start speculating, and I actually saw this soundbite where an anchor said, could this be like a black hole? And a scientific expert said, even a pinpoint black hole would suck in our entire solar system. No. You know, I mean, why even say that?
Exactly right. I mean, at one point, the HLN, the former Headline News, the sister network of CNN, brought in a psychic to help find the plane. I mean, it was just sort of low-end annex that just really cheapened the brand. but it brought in the viewers. And it's really a very sad thing for, you know, what has long been a respected news institution to kind of resort to this kind of gimmickry.
After we take a short break, we'll be back with Rem Ryder and also be bringing in a psychic tarot card reader for the second half of our program. You're listening to Let's Consider the Source on XM Channel 121, Sirius Channel 205.
If you're considering a career in media, consider Caldwell College. We're located just minutes from New York City, the nation's media capital. But it's what happens on our 70-acre suburban New Jersey campus which is most important. Caldwell's communications department is designed to give you the preparation you need to compete in this constantly changing field. The radio studio used for this national broadcast is the same facility you will use to learn professional-level radio performance and production. Caldwell's primary emphasis is broadcast journalism, but we also provide great courses in screenwriting, TV production, video editing, and of course, communications theory. One course even allows students to attend discussions with filmmakers, screenwriters, and actors. The full-time faculty is comprised of working media professionals, including Professor Bob Mann, the host of Let's Consider the Source. Go to www.caldwell.edu, then click on the Academics tab for details. Caldwell College, the key to your communications future.
Bob Mann back here with more of Let's Consider the Source, our weekly media issues talk show. Our guest, Rem Ryder of USA Today, media editor and columnist. Rem, you have some good news for us. Very often when you've been on the program, we've been talking about the state of the news media. And every year, the Pew Research Center comes out usually with a list of bad news bullet points. But this year, it's a little different. Tell us about it.
Yeah, it was a very refreshing change. Year after year, as you mentioned, the Pew Research Center does probably the most exhaustive study of the state of the news media. It's really a serious piece of work. And generally, what you find is that there are fewer and fewer reporters because there's less and less advertising at legacy news outlets like primarily newspapers, which, despite all the new players, the newspapers still have a disproportionate amount of the reporting firepower. Well, this year there was a different flavor to the report, and it mentioned a number of things that we've talked about on the show over the past year, and that's one kind of the spreading of the wings of places like BuzzFeed, that's usually known for silly cat pictures and lists of, you know, the hottest film stars around, that kind of thing, branching out into serious news. BuzzFeed now has foreign bureaus and an investigative reporting unit and long-form journalism. Vox Media has hired Ezra Klein, who had been at the Washington Post. They're a star policy analyst, and he's hiring a bunch of people to analyze policy. Number of new entities broadening their role into serious journalism, plus a bunch of new players, some from the world of tech, very wealthy players. We've had Jeff Bezos of Amazon fame buying the Washington Post. We've had a Pierre Omidyar, the eBay founder, who's launching his own expensive, to the tune of $250 million news operation. We've Glenn Greenwald of the Snowden story, famous as his star attraction. And we've had John Henry, the owner of the Boston Red Sox, buy the struggling Boston Globe. And so there's a lot of ferment, and for the first time, Pew tried to tabulate at digital-only places the amount of journalists, and they found 5,000 journalism jobs had been created. Now, this doesn't offset by any means the kind of steady loss of firepower at legacy news organizations, and still it was still heavily dependent on newspapers for reporting jobs, and still much of the revenue for news outlets comes from advertising. But we are seeing a shift, and at one point I think they say, well, you might say this is a drop in the bucket. It's a pretty heavy drop. So I think, you know, it's kind of good to there's a lot of causes for concern, and I'll talk about one in a second. But it's good not just kind of wallow in the gloom endlessly when there are some exciting green shoots sprouting out there. So, you know, they're not saying, okay, we fixed everything, but it's just that there are these new bright spots that are very encouraging. My big concern remains coverage of local news, because a lot of the kind of, particularly at the mid-size newspapers, continue to struggle as their ad revenue and print goes down, the digital ad revenue has been disappointing. Some are making money now by charging for digital content. But overall, it's still a challenge, and the rosters, as some of them continue to shrink, there are fewer reporters. And we've had this cool phenomenon where a bunch of digital outlets have sprung up that cover local news, whether it's the investigative band or overall coverage of the region. And that's great, and I'm excited about that. But many of these are like 2 and 3 or one-person operations. And some are bigger, but almost none of them have the kind of staff that we've been used to with newspapers to really cover a region. And so I think that remains the most pressing problem ahead. A lot of the new investment of these new players has been in investigative reporting and in foreign reporting, both very important. But a democracy really needs strong local news. So this is, it's not just about journalism, it's about democracy. And so I think that the biggest challenge for the future is how is local news going to be funded?
Rem, I'm going to pick your brain here because of the fact that you've been a reporter and editor at major newspapers. You've also worked in a university environment. I'm going to be going to a conference next month talking about connecting the communication curriculum in colleges and universities much more with careers in media. What do you think should be the way that universities and colleges go in terms of training? Because so many people say to me, because I'm chair of my department here at Caldwell, are you doing all social media? Well, I don't see social media necessarily generating mainstream jobs. If you were redesigning a curriculum, knowing what you know and having been exposed to both the academic side and the real world side, what would you say are some of the changes that they really do need to implement?
Well, I think there really needs to be a mix. And I think digital fluency is critical. And I think many schools were kind of slow, as many news companies were, to adapt to the digital age. So I think digital fluency really is important and needs to be taught. We're talking about students who are digital natives, but that doesn't mean they necessarily have mastered a lot of digital journalism techniques. But I think at the same time, it's really important not to lose sight of kind of the bedrock journalism practices and values, because no matter what the platform is or no matter how the field evolves, without those reporting and writing skills, you're really not going to be a very strong journalist. So it's really asking a lot of these institutions because there's no doubt that the digital end of it is important. But I don't think you want it to be completely focused on learning those techniques at the expense of learning writing and reporting and focusing on ethics, which is so important. There are so many new ethical challenges posed by the digital age, having a sense of history. So it's really, it's asking a lot. But I think it's very important for the careers of those young journalists.
I've been concerned that opinion is news, which we've talked about so often, could really have an impact on policy that America will take toward Russia in terms of the Ukraine-Crimea situation. Clearly, there are people in right-wing media pretending to be news, but it's clearly opinion and talk, where they're talking about Obama is weak. This is why Putin's doing what he's doing. Is there any chance, not to the level of, yellow journalism back in the days of the Spanish-American War, but is there any chance that this constant drumming of the beating of the drum about Obama being weak and enabling Putin could in any way influence foreign policy? Or do you think that the opinion channels just don't have that kind of reach into D.C.?
Well, it varies kind of from issue to issue. I think when there's a steady across-the-board drumbeat, it can have an impact. But if it's very much coming from the right, in a case like this, I don't think it's going to affect policy very much. I think, I like to think the president is stronger than that, because really it's unclear to me what the critics who say he's weak. And I can't say I think he's been a master of foreign policy, but I'm not sure exactly what they want him to do.
And let's just end with you referring to something written by Paul Fahrer. Didn't he used to write for you at American Journalism Review?
He sure did. Paul is a wonderful media writer who writes for The Washington Post. And I think for over a 10-year period, he might have been in almost every issue of American Journalism Review with a major story, one of the best media writers out there. And he did a really clever thing. If you read the media at all, you know, particularly in the digital media, these lists of nine things you need to know about X are so popular. And so I forget now what the headline was. Maybe you have it in front of you, but it was something like, nine reasons you're reading this list, or something like that.
Top 10 things that these kind of people do. Eight reasons why you'll be happy.
And this was nine reasons why you're reading this list. And he in a very sophisticated way, went into the reason these things are so popular. And he didn't do it in, what I like about Paul is he has a good tone. He didn't do it in a sneering, snarky way. He made it, I mean, he kind of gently made fun of the obsession with these lists, BuzzFeed being the king and queen of such lists, but everybody's doing them, including USA Today. And they're actually often popular and also can be educational. We did a thing in USA Today with Facebook spending its billions to acquire Oculus and a virtual reality firm. And it was basically five things you need to know about virtual reality. So I think that, and Paul's point was there's a reason for these. They're overused. And then he basically said maybe now that they might even be on their way out, kind of that it's so crowded nobody goes there, that they reach that level. But I thought it was just a really smart way to get at it.
Rem, we love having you on the show, and it's always amazing how fast the half hour goes, and we hope you take our call when we call you again in a couple of weeks.
You know I will. Always look forward to it, Bob.
Rem Ryder, who is media editor and columnist for USA Today, right here on Let's Consider the Source.
If you're considering a career in media, consider Caldwell College. We're located just minutes from New York City, the nation's media capital, but it's what happens on our 70-acre suburban New Jersey campus which is most important. Caldwell's communications department is designed to stress the preparation you need to compete in this constantly changing field. For more information, go to www.caldwell.edu, then hit the Academics tab for more details. Caldwell College, the key to your communications future.
Let's Consider the Source is also a production of Media Educators Association, a not-for-profit organization established to foster a better understanding of the power of media and film in society today. MEA presents the Saturday Morning Film Festival in New York City. Members attend advance preview screenings of new Hollywood, independent, and foreign language films from film festivals around the world. Whenever possible, filmmakers join us for discussions of their projects. For further information, go to mediaeducators.org.
That's it for this edition of Let's Consider the Source. The producer and creator of this program is yours truly, Bob Mann. The co-producer and technical supervisor is Nick Amabil. The associate producer is John Yurko. This program is produced by the Communication Arts Department at Caldwell College in Caldwell, New Jersey, in association with Mann Media Incorporated and Media Educators Association. The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the producers, underwriters, or SiriusXM Radio. If you have any comments or questions, please email me, rmann@caldwell.edu. That's R-M-A-N-N at Caldwell, C-A-L-D-W-E-L-L.edu. I also invite you to follow me on Twitter at Bob Mann Media. Of course, we want you to join us every week on SiriusXM Public Radio as we discuss the nation's most important and interesting media issues. But before we examine any issue, let's consider the source.